This is the guest lecture from the 2019 OutStories Bristol Annual General Meeting. The speaker is Professor Jennifer Inglehart, Head of the Department of Classics at the University of Durham.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you for having me here to speak in this very fancy building. I'm not sure I've ever given a talk where there's been a birthday cake before. I think that's absolutely lovely. Can I just check that the handouts have gone round the room? Because this is going to be a very textually based talk. I decided to put it on old-fashioned paper rather than put the text up there on the screen for you, because I am very much going to be talking about text today. Has everyone got a handout? Yeah? Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to speak at the John Addington Symonds Lecture. It's a great honour and pleasure to be able to talk about queer classics on Symonds' birthday. And Symonds features a little bit in the talk that I'm going to be giving today. He features as the translator of some of the texts that I'm going to be talking about, and I will actually talk about some of his translations because I think they're absolutely marvellous translations. But my main focus today is on another queer classicist, A. Housman. Housman's most famous as a poet, and loss is a theme of much of his poetry. Much of the verse he wrote is concerned with death, sorrow, the heartlessness of the universe, and the themes of his poems are summed up in the first quotation on your handout, a description of his first collection of poetry, A Shropshire Lad. It's rather a caricature, but there's quite a lot of truth in that description of A Shropshire Lad as well. And this description comes from Tom Stoppard's wonderful play, The Invention of Love, which sympathetically and movingly explores Housman's unhappy, unrequited love, the emergence of his understanding of his homosexual nature, and his dual identity as both a poet and a professor. Many people have heard of Housman as a poet, but a lot of people are less aware of his identity as a classicist. But he was a really eminent classical scholar. He was Professor of Latin at University College London and later at Cambridge, and he devoted most of his professional life as a classicist to restoring the losses of antiquity. And he did this primarily by working as a textual critic, trying to establish the actual words that Roman authors had written, recovering them from the mistakes that had been made in manuscripts that had been copied and then recopied many times. And the items under the first heading on your handout are just a few examples of how in his scholarship he has quite an emotional response to the many losses of antiquity. So he talks about the wreck of antiquity, for example. I could have found many more examples, but I didn't want to overwhelm the handout. So Housman was acutely sensitive to the losses of the ancient world, the material he dealt with in his working life. But he also suffered many personal losses. His mother died when he was only 13 years old. One of his brothers was killed fighting in the Boer War. But Housman also experienced some particularly queer losses. He might have become one of the greatest classical scholars of his age, yet he failed his finals in classics at Oxford in 1881. And the reasons for his failure in finals have been endlessly debated, but one explanation that people coming back to over and over again is that Housman failed his finals because he had some sort of homosexual panic. So while he was an undergraduate at Oxford, he fell in love with his best friend and fellow undergraduate, Moses Jackson. Jackson wasn't a good choice for Housman to fall in love with. He was a scientist, he was an athlete, he didn't share Housman's classical interests, but even more importantly, he couldn't share Housman's erotic feelings for him. He was completely heterosexual. I suspect that the real crisis between the two men didn't come when Housman was sitting his finals, that it came later when the men were both working together at the patent office after university and sharing lodgings together in North London. We learn that in the autumn of 1885, Housman simply disappeared for a week. Nobody knew what he was doing. After that week where he went missing, Housman and Jackson no longer lived together, but they did remain friends, although there was a bit of a distance in their friendship. It seems likely to me that the distance that came between them at this point was caused by Housman's love being revealed to Jackson. And I'd see some suggestive confirmation of this in the circumstances that surround Jackson's wedding. Jackson moved to India in 1887 to become a school principal. When he returned home on leave to Britain in 1889, he married a widow, Rosa Chambers, but he didn't actually tell Houseman about the wedding in advance of the wedding, and he didn't invite the man who had once been his best friend along to the wedding. And the poems about the blight of love in Houseman's work often reflect his unrequited love for Jackson. Jackson remained the emotional centre of Houseman's life, despite the distance between the two men. And the distance wasn't just an emotional distance, it became physical as well. Jackson had moved to India, he later moved to Vancouver in British Columbia. He died in 1923, though the two men did correspond right up to the end of Jackson's life. Now, several writers who have training in the classics haven't always treated Houseman's poetry or his losses very kindly, as the items under the heading, oh, woe, 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 etc. on your handout show. We've got mocking criticism of his poetry here as being one note. The stereotype is that his poetry is full of complaints, obsessed with death and with sorrow, and it's also dismissed as being ridiculously old-fashioned and trite. But the Donna Tartt extract that I've put on there also shows that Houseman's poetry is capable of evoking an immense answering pain in the audience who read or hear it. These passages also include criticism of Houseman on a personal level. He's criticised for the failure to live fully by retreating from his sexuality and from his emotions into dry as dust classical scholarship, which is seen as an evasion of real life. I'd want to argue that classical scholarship wasn't for Houseman any such thing, and that we can and should take seriously Houseman's loss and his sorrow and how he approaches them and articulates them through the classics. And that's the topic of my talk today. Although I've worked a lot on Rome in my previous work, my focus today is mostly on how Houseman's poetry engages with loss through the figure of the Greek lesbian poet Sappho. But Houseman's classical engagements are rarely simple, and I will be talking about some other authors he uses as well. I'm also interested in looking at this topic in what Houseman's approach to loss through the classics might mean for queer classicists today, and that's where I want to go towards the end of my talk. But let's just talk a little bit more about Sappho. Sappho is a very obvious figure for classicists who are interested in loss to turn to. She's basically an icon of loss, a poster girl for loss. So Sappho, a lyric poet-singer from the island of Lesbos, who was born in the 7th century BC, is the most famous female poet from the entire ancient world. But her major reputation and influence are at odds with the extremely small amount of her poetry that's actually survived from the early period in which she wrote. In the later Hellenistic period, her poems were collected into 9 books of poetry, but all we have today is a collection of fragments, often preserved on scraps of torn and tattered pieces of papyrus, her poems literally in pieces. Some of the fragments we have are as short as a single word, but even so, I think these fragments can give a good idea of Sappho's characteristic themes of love, friendship, desire, memory, immortality, and loss. And women, of course, feature very frequently in Sappho's poetry, and very frequently as those that she loves or desires, although usually she's unsuccessful in her pursuit of these women. Well, Sappho plays an important role in Tom Stoppard's The Invention of Love, a play I mentioned earlier, which is full of references to and quotations from the classical authors that Houseman worked on, including many Greek and Roman love poets. Houseman never published on the Greek poet Sappho, who only features once in Stoppard's play, but where she features and what she does in the play is really critical. She turns up at a really important moment, at the start of the scene in which Houseman's love for Moses Jackson is revealed to Jackson in their lodgings in North London, in what seems to me a very imaginative, convincing and devastating reconstruction of how the friendship between these two men might have cooled. I find it very significant that this scene opens with a translation written in Houseman's own handwriting of one of the most famous fragments of Sappho, fragment 31. In the play, the figure of Houseman is coy about the authorship of the translation, as well he should be, because this isn't actually Houseman's translation of Sappho. It's an adaptation, presumably meant to be Houseman's own adaptation, of an earlier 1711 translation of the poem by Ambrose Phillips. This poem, Sappho, Fragment 31, is a classic and often translated love poem, and I've given you Simmons's wonderful translation on your handout. Just to sum up what's going on in Sappho 31, in this poem, Sappho, the I speaker of the poem, watches very much as an outsider, as a man and a woman converse. She feels extreme desire for the woman, and that desire leads her to experience a range of different physical effects, but she's unable to speak as well, and that's a really important effect. The poem's often been read as being about a love triangle in which Sappho's naturally excluded from the love between a man and a woman. And that scenario of Sappho's poem is of obvious relevance to the situation of Houseman and Jackson. It's clear from this scene in Stoppard that Jackson has recently embarked on an erotic relationship with Rosa, the woman he's eventually going to marry. He's asking Houseman to help him out by helping him with some ancient love poetry that might help to win her over. And Houseman's exclusion from a close relationship with Jackson comes about precisely because Rosa is able to see that Houseman also has erotic feelings for Jackson. And these are feelings which Houseman has never been able to articulate out loud to Jackson. Although leaving poetry about a love triangle and undeclared homoerotic love around for Jackson to read is one rather coded way of declaring his love, though one that doesn't work. Jackson wasn't a classicist. He's not able to understand the message that Sappho Fragment 31 might give him, just as he doesn't get Houseman's declaration of his own position as a devoted erotic slave to Jackson in the Latin of Propertius that he quotes in this scene. He assumes this is something you might use with Rosa. And in this very insightful scene, Tom Stoppard reflects on how Sappho's homoerotic love poetry is used in Houseman's verse as a way of talking about his own unfulfilled love, a love that cannot be openly articulated. And this leads me on to look at my first set of examples of Houseman's use of Sappho to express loss. I want to start by looking at two adaptations by Houseman of a poem that's usually identified as being by Sappho. Now, some people question that the poem's by Sappho, but it seems plausible that it was created by Sappho for a number of reasons. Firstly, the poem has a female speaker, as we get from the feminine ending of the word mona, alone, in the first line. Secondly, the theme of that poem is the frequent sapphic one of unrequited love and the absence of the beloved, even though that theme isn't explicitly spelled out as being the theme within the poem. And finally, I think we can be fairly sure that this poem is by Sappho because it has very characteristic sapphic simplicity, brevity, and control. At any rate, some scholars deny that the poem is by Sappho, but many readers have responded on a very emotional level to the poem's suggestive, delicately sketched scenario. And those who've responded to the poem are not least queer readers, who found a particular poignancy in the theme of unfulfilled desire and that experience of lying awake, unloved, in the middle of the night, a time when all of nature acts as it might be expected to, and heterosexual couples are bedded down together. Well, I've given you as one example of such queer responses to the poem, the earlier translation by Simmons. Simmons's translation both expands and makes more emotionally clear what a simple and unadorned statement in the Greek poem in a number of ways. Simmons uses the word lost, which has no counterpart in the Greek poem. He notes that the speaker lies down on my couch, which I would say increases the sexual temperature of what the reader of the Greek is left to infer as an erotic scenario. And Simmons also translates the Greek verb parerkamai in line 3 with slips by. More literally, that Greek word means simply that time passes by. So Simmons creates a greater sense of loss, of being unable to pin down and hold on to time, and by implication, being unable to hold on to a beloved. And Simmons's translation, which I think is a great translation, makes the poem more emotive by showing the speaker's plight as erotic and pitiable. Well, in his two adaptations of the poem, Houseman inserts himself into this tradition of using Sappho by taking on her voice to articulate an acutely queer experience of loss and absence, amplifying her emotion. And just like Simmons before him, he expands the sapphic poem, as can easily be seen from the fact that the Sappho is four very short lines in length, but both of Houseman's versions are 8 lines long. Some critics have objected that Houseman supplements the poem and removes too much of its simplicity, but I think they're misunderstanding his poetics of adaptation as well as the nature of the sapphic poem. That sapphic poem has sometimes been treated as a complete poem, but we can't be certain that it's not a fragment, as so many of Sappho's poems are. If we see it as a fragment, I think we get a perfect explanation of why Houseman's translating it twice with 8 lines rather than the 4 lines of the original. Houseman is expanding by saying out loud things that Sappho's only hinting at, that she may have gone on to say in a now lost portion of a longer poem. Well, Houseman's 2 poems adapting this sapphic poem were only published posthumously in the collection More Poems, poems which his brother Lawrence published on the basis of what Houseman had written in his notebooks. And it's the notebooks that prove that Houseman was thinking about Jackson when he wrote these poems. In 1922, Houseman copied out a fair copy of the poem that's the topic of my next section, Epithalamion, which was written about the wedding of Jackson, and put it in his notebook next to poem 10, which is there on your handout. And this guarantees, to my mind, that he connected the poem and its theme of being separated from the beloved with Jackson and his own separation from Jackson. And that Houseman's playing with the sapphic voice and producing adaptations of her poem rather than straightforward translations is clear from the fact that there are 2 variations on the same theme placed next to each other in Houseman's notebooks. And the notebooks and where they place poems spell out that the poems treat Houseman's unrequited longing for Jackson. But the fact that he approaches this theme through poems which adapt Sappho could be seen as a way in which Houseman is distancing himself from his own erotic disappointment and unfulfilled desire. He's not addressing it directly in the first-person voice that's entirely his own. He's also looking to Sappho to do so. But Houseman expands on Sappho, even more obviously perhaps than Simmons's translation had done, increasing the sense of pathos and sorrow in her poem. One way in which Houseman does this is through the pathetic fallacy that nature shares in the unhappy emotions of the abandoned speaker of the poem. So the constellation of the Pleiades or the 7 sisters are described as weeping, and the rainy breeze sighs in poem 10. The pathetic fallacy is a conceit which is absent from the Sappho poem, but it neatly, if somewhat obliquely, expresses the lover's pain here. And I think the lover's pain is also evoked by the way in which the word born evokes, by at least sound play, the word mourn. But Houseman makes the poem personal to himself, even as he adapts a poem by Sappho, not least when poem 11, the second version, spells out that Houseman's love is unreciprocated and that this is why he lies down alone. References to the lost country and the land beyond the seas in these poems also evokes the fact that the separation between the lover and beloved in Houseman's case was caused at least in part by the fact of Jackson's geographical separation, being first in India, later in British Columbia. And I think that geographical separation between Houseman and Jackson is further hinted at by the use of the rare verb wester in these poems. It's not a verb we use commonly, I would say. It means to travel westward in its course. It evokes the west, and hence, I would say, by association, the east, and the vast distance between Jackson and Houseman in the period in which Houseman was actually writing this poem. Both of Houseman's adaptations of Sappho's poem have a much greater focus on the distance that the heavenly bodies have to travel than is found in the sapphic original. And I think this increases the sense of an unbridgeable distance between the lover and his beloved. In using that unusual verb wester, I don't think Houseman's just hinting at the East, though. I think he's also combining classical or classicising sources to articulate more fully his sense of queer loss. The Oxford English Dictionary cites various usages of wester. There are some up until the 15th century, and then there's quite a big period where no one's using this term wester at all in the sense that Houseman's using it. until 1791, after the 15th century, is the next example the Oxford English Dictionary gives. And this verb's found in William Cowper's translation of Homer, Iliad 23, 194-195. And now the lamp of day, westering apace, had left them still in tears. In this translation, westering is translating the Homeric verb duno, a form of which appears as the first word of Sappho's poem, deduce. The verb literally means simply to set. And I want to suggest that by using the verb wester, and in particular with by combining this with the notion of the weeping Pleiades in poem 10, Houseman's looking to the translation of Homer and its wider context. For in Iliad 23, Achilles, along with his companions, is mourning for his beloved Patroclus, who has recently died. Just before we read about the light of day westering, yet night not bringing to an end to the tears of the Greeks, Achilles has performed a very powerful act of mourning for Patroclus by cutting off a lock of his own hair to dedicate to him, as the extract from Cowper's translation on your handout shows. So by alluding to this translation of Homer with the verb wester, Houseman increases the homoeroticism of the sapphic poem that he's adapting. For Achilles and Patroclus were often taken as the very type of devoted homoerotic lovers. And Houseman's also amplifying the sorrow and sense of loss in his adaptation, since Achilles experienced very extreme grief over the loss of Patroclus. And so by alluding to this translation of Homer, Houseman hints at the depth of his mourning over the loss of the specifically male beloved. And Houseman's sense of the loss of a male beloved is even more explicit in the next poem I want to consider. This is Last Poems 24. Houseman gave this poem the title Epithalamium, and that's a Greek word which refers to the song for a newlywed couple that was sung by family and friends on the wedding night at the thalamos, or the bridal chamber. I want to suggest that this poem, Epithalamium, is the queerest poem in all of Houseman. It twists both the ancient and modern conventions of songs that celebrate weddings. That's not really that surprising if you think that it was written to celebrate the wedding of Moses Jackson to Rosa Chambers, a wedding to which Houseman was not invited, and he only discovered that it had taken place after the event. So Houseman's choice of title, a wedding song for a newlywed couple sung on the wedding night, doubly encodes a bitter acknowledgement of Houseman's distance from Jackson. The title comments on the necessary exclusion and distance of Houseman from the happy heterosexual couple. But the title's also an ironic reminder that Houseman wasn't even there to see the wedding day, to celebrate the wedding in the customary manner, even though within the poem he presents himself as the best man or groomsman and as actually having been present at the wedding. Well, this poem was begun in the 1890s, at least in a fragmentary state, but Houseman completed it only many years after the wedding had taken place, and he published it in the final collection of poems that he published in his own lifetime, Last Poems, a collection which Houseman sent a copy of to Jackson when Jackson was lying on his deathbed. God knows what Jackson made of this poem. It's a very strange poem to send someone about their wedding. But that title, Epithalamium, also makes the reader think of Sappho, who is the most famous ancient writer of Epithalamia. And her poetry is a natural place to go to in order to articulate the specifically queer losses that are associated with marriage, not least because Sappho is believed to have written Epithalamia that were performed at the weddings of women who were part of her circle of friends and lovers. Unfortunately, we only have very short fragments that remain out of the poems that are generally agreed to be her epithalamia. And these poems by Sappho include praise of the bridegroom, metaphors for the unattainability of the bride, grieving over the loss of the bride's virginity, but also there are statements calling the wedded couple happy and blessed. And one of Sappho's fragments, while very brief, is clearly an important influence on Houseman's poem. And this is Sappho fragment 104a, which I've given on your handout together with Simmons's translation. Well, Simmons, like almost all translators of the poem, makes Hesper, or the evening star, reunite various pairs that have been separated during the day. So the lamb is reunited with the ewe, the kid with the nanny goat, the human child with the mother. And Sappho may well have used the image of Hesper, as Houseman does at lines 15 and following of his Epithalamium, to suggest that the night brings together strongly bonded pairs who naturally belong together, just as the bride and groom do. But another interpretation of Sappho's poem is possible. We can understand the word apu in line 2 of the Greek as an adverb, in which case it would express that Hesper is taking the child away from its mother. It's worth noting that while Symonds genders the child in his translation, there's no explicit gendering of the child in the Greek. We just learn that there's a child. If we go with this interpretation, where apu means away, Sappho is saying that the evening brings the lamb and the kid back to their mothers, but these animals are reunited in contrast to the human girl who's taken away from her mother by the eve of her marriage, as in the translation I've given you by Anne Pippin Burnett on your handout. But even if we don't follow this interpretation, it seems to me that Houseman must have been influenced in his Epithalamium by the sapphic fragment's focus on separation, as the dawn parts the various children-mother pairs in the first line. Houseman's phrasing of join and part in line 2 of his poem neatly expresses this duality. The wedding joins the bride and groom, but it parts the groomsman, that is Houseman himself, from the groom whom he loves no less than the bride does, as he says. What did Jackson make on reading this? I have no idea. I mean, goodness knows. And I think it's that sense of separation is why Houseman includes an adaptation of the sapphic fragment in lines 15 to 21 of his poem. So although on the surface, and taken apart from the rest of Houseman's Epithalamium, these lines express happiness at the union of the heterosexual couple on their wedding night, and lines 15 to 21 themselves never actually mention parting, it is the flip side of the joining that occurs on the wedding night. And we can't read joining and parting separately from each other. That sense of separation that's inherent in Sappho's fragment is insisted on earlier in the poem, in lines 4 to 8. I'd say that in his Epithalamium, Houseman is bringing out the queerness that's latent in what remains of Sappho's Epithalamia. Scholars have noted that the fragments of Sappho that can be securely identified as belonging to this genre don't explicitly express any desire for the departed bride or sorrow at her separation from the sapphic speaker. But it seems entirely plausible to me that in the portions of the Epithalamia that are now lost, Sappho did precisely this. But I think what Houseman's doing here is, in a sense, filling in the blanks of Sappho's fragments of wedding songs by showing just how devastating an experience of loss is experienced by queer people as a consequence of heterosexual marriage. Another sense of queer loss that Houseman's poem expresses through its classical reception, albeit rather obliquely, is the loss of the possibility of producing children. At lines 37 to 8 of the poem, Jackson is exhorted to breed sons who will stave off the rot of time. That is, have children so that they'll give you immortality. Well, having children who are going to give immortality simply isn't a possibility for Houseman, the homosexual poet. And to my mind, the specific wording of the opening lines of the Epithalamium hints at this fact. The first two lines of the poem are a close translation of an address to Hymen, the Roman god of marriage, that's found in an Epithalamium by the Roman poet Catullus. One of Catullus's poems, by the way, that are heavily indebted to Sappho's poems, and I've put those relevant lines of the Latin and a translation on your handout. By starting his poem with Catullan lines that mention Hymen's parentage from the goddess Urania, Houseman insists on the fact that one aspect of marriage is that it leads to children and the continuation of families. Now, the word Urania had taken on a rather different meaning in Houseman's time from that which it had when Catullus wrote. By the time in which Houseman was writing, Uranian was being used as a code word for homoerotic love and the men who experienced it. And in using the word in this sense, they were looking back to a discussion in Plato's Symposium about heavenly or Uranian love, Aphrodite Uranios, which is identified with high-minded homoerotic love and contrasted with love that is more earthy, the sort of love that can produce human children that a man and a woman might have together. So Urania's son has a double meaning in Hausmann's poem. On one level, it simply translates Catullus and describes Hausmann. But for the Hymen. But for those who understand its contemporary Platonic force, it may suggest that Hausmann himself is Urania's son. Someone, because of his homosexual nature, he's unable to participate in the generative possibilities of heterosexual marriage. He's never going to become a father himself. Perhaps I'm reading too much onto the poem here. I'm absolutely certain Moses Jackson, who wasn't a classicist, would not have got this when reading the poem. But to return to Hausmann's use of Sappho, I think her fragmentary epithalamia are also echoed, at least to my mind, in Hausmann's method of composition. So in the first pencil draft of this poem that exists in the notebooks, all we have are the title and those lines that I've marked out in bold on your handout. Many years later, he returned to the poem and he fleshed out the entire poem around those bare bones of the title and those few lines. I find it very suggestive that a poem which incorporates a very obviously fragmentary wedding song by Sappho itself started out life as a collection of mere fragments. And the first of these, Hausmann's statement at lines 7-8, that friend and comrade yield you over to her that hardly loves you more, I think these lines might, if we gender swapped them, in terms of queer content, have been written by Sappho herself, as she mourned the loss of a girl she loved from her circle of friends and lovers. Now, it's pretty clear that these lines have a personal and autobiographical resonance for Hausmann. They're talking about Hausmann's desire and love for Jackson. But I think they're also setting Hausmann in a long, sad tradition of the queer suffering that comes when loved ones get married and you can't get to be married to them yourself, however much you would like to. Well, the final poem I want to look at today toys with an end to Hausmann's erotic suffering. I find it an absolutely extraordinary poem. It was completed in 1922 as Jackson lay dying of stomach cancer in British Columbia. And the poem looks forward to Jackson's death, imagining that Hausmann's going to be set free from the bonds of his feelings for Jackson by his own death. This wasn't a poem that Jackson ever read, by the way. More poems are published posthumously, so at least he didn't send this one to Jackson, who he was still apparently in love with at this point. It's an extraordinary poem. It doesn't spell out its classical influences, but it's obviously classical in a broad sense. It begins with reference to the ferry in which, in Greek myth, the boatman Charon transported the dead across the rivers of the underworld to Hades, once they'd paid him their fee of one obol to make the trip from which there was no return to the land of the living. You have to understand this to get the poem. But the poem also contains less obvious classical elements. The second stanza touches on the slavery of love that was so important to the Latin love poet Propertius, on whom Hausmann worked for many years. There are other classical elements as well. So the second stanza alludes in mentioning the just city to Plato's nation of a perfect city in his republic. But I want to suggest that this poem of loss is also classical in that it engages closely with a poem by Sappho, although previous readers don't seem to have recognised a sapphic intertext before this. But I think there are clear and multiple parallels between More Poems 23 and Sappho Fragment 55, which I've put on your handout, again with Simmons's translation. So both of these poems constitute a vindictive address to an unnamed you, who is imagined as being dead in the future, for whom an undesirable post-mortem fate in Hades is mapped out. The addressee is described in the first word of both poems with a participle which denotes their future dead state, and the speaker in both poems tells the addressee that they're going to be forgotten in the underworld. The notion that the addressee is going to be forgotten because he's no longer loved by Hausmann who had previously been his devoted slave, is more or less spelled out in Houseman's poem, depending on what text we choose to print. The edition of More Poems, which was published posthumously by Houseman's brother, Lawrence Houseman, makes the notion of the forgetting that death brings rather clearer by printing an earlier version of line 3 that Houseman later crossed out, where Houseman had written, "Whom on the wharf of Lethe waiting." If we print this text, we have an explicit reference to Lethe, the river of forgetting in the underworld, from which the dead in Hades drink and then forget about their former lives and aren't tortured with the thought of what's going on in the world of the living. What Houseman crossed out and replaced that with in line 3 is "whom on the far quayside in waiting," concealing that reference to Lethe and forgetting that you'd know about if you know about the rivers of the classical underworld. I actually prefer Houseman's second version, "whom on the far quayside in waiting," because I think what we have here is an allusion to one of the most poignant phrases that's found in Virgil, at Aeneid 6, 314, where the souls of the unburied who want to be ferried to the underworld by Charon are depicted as stretching out their arms, ripae ulterioris amore, which is often translated as in desire for the far bank. The far bank of the river, they want to get over there and forget about their former lives and just be happier than they possibly could be, remembering with misery what it was like to be alive. And one commentator has noted how that phrase, ripae ulterioris amore, expresses the elusive distance of the shore and the pathetic longings of the ghosts. And reference to pathetic longings, to my mind, fits well with the way in which Houseman's poem ironically contains the failure of his renunciation of desire, even as the poem proclaims it. Houseman asserts that he would be set free from his hopeless love of Jackson in the future once they're both dead. But the fact that he makes this assertion in a present in which he's still clearly a slave to his love fatally undermines the poem's wish to be free of desire. It shows the extent to which Houseman's predictions constitute a pathetic form of wish fulfillment in the here and now. And if we have a knowledge of classical poetry, I think this further helps to undermine Houseman. Houseman spent much of his life working on the love elegist Propertius. Two frequent themes of Propertius's poetry are that he's a hopeless slave to love and that his love will cross even the borders of death. So even as he claims that his own love will not transcend death, Houseman is evoking a classical author who suggests again and again quite the opposite of this. I want to go back, though, to Sappho fragment 55. I want to suggest that Houseman's poem owes a debt to his sapphic intertext in terms of the way in which it ironically undermines its own assertion that Houseman's going to be freed from erotic sorrow. Now, Simmons's version of Sappho translates at line 2 the transmitted text tote, which means then, making the point that Sappho's addressee will not be remembered either at the point at which she dies or later in the future in years to come. But I don't think we should print tote there. I would prefer to print potha, a word meaning desire, which is the conjecture of two German scholars, and it's a conjecture that Houseman was highly likely to have known about. If we print potha, I would translate lines 1 to 2 as, "When you die, you will lie there, and there will in future be no memory of you, nor desire for you in the future." If we read the word potha, desire, then, Sappho isn't just telling her addressee that she won't be remembered after her death. She's also pointedly spelling out that no one's going to desire this woman after she's dead. And this makes Sappho's poem an early version of the theme that the grave is a fine and private place, but that none do there embrace. Sappho's basically trying to threaten this woman, but also entice her into a love affair with her. The woman's clearly rejected Sappho erotically, and Sappho's trying to tempt her into embracing her here and now while love is still a possibility, threatening her that if she does not allow herself to be loved by Sappho while she still can, she won't be immortalised by Sappho's poetry. I think this must be what is meant by the reference in lines 2 to 3 to the woman having no share in the roses of Pieria. For Mount Pieria is the home of the muses, the daughters of memory. This woman is warned that she won't be immortalised in Sappho's love poetry, which often includes the rose as an erotic symbol. And the irony in Sappho's poem, then, is absolutely identical with the irony that's found in Houseman's poem. Sappho may not name this woman, but she is immortalising her and her failed desire for her in the very poem which proclaims that this woman is going to be forgotten. It's hard to be set free from queer love, however much you may desire this. And Houseman's plight, of course, was much worse than Sappho's, in that he knew that he and Jackson could never be together. Jackson wasn't capable of returning his love. Poems, threats, devotion, all of these are equally, ultimately hopeless. Houseman was never going to be with the man he loved. Well, in conclusion, I just want to sketch out a few ways in which Houseman's queer loss and suffering might still matter for queer classicists today. I think it's really important that we acknowledge that individual suffering and loss are still very much a part of the queer experience. I know that's at odds with how we as a community strive to celebrate our pride in our identities, our survival, the progress we've made in terms of legal and social acceptance, particularly since the days in which Houseman was living, when homosexual acts were illegal and had to be hidden, when it was dangerous to confess your queer love. Well, in her wonderful meditation on queer loss, Feeling Backward, Heather Love has suggested that we should not attempt to deny or disavow the past queer losses or to find the positives in negative feelings. Heather Love says that rather we should take on board the powerful legacies of these things for us as queer people, taking the past seriously on its own terms, seeing the persistence of the past in the present. So if we vibrate to the chord of pain and loss that's found in Houseman's poetry, as many queer classicists have done and still do, I think we need to acknowledge and incorporate this into our classical scholarship. Classical studies don't bias immunity from emotions such as sorrow at loss and from the pain of unrequited love. Indeed, as queer people, we have a historical experience of love being bound up with loss, as Heather Love has observed. Moreover, I think it's important to recognise that classics is a discipline that by its very nature involves loss. There's a massive distance between us and antiquity. All of the evidence that survives from the ancient world is fragmentary. Whether that evidence is literally fragmentary, as in the case of Sappho's poems, or not, we don't have a complete picture of antiquity. We never can. It's really separated from us by a very great distance. And Houseman and his scholarship tried to restore antiquity to wholeness, as he worked on texts that he saw as having been saved, often in a mutilated form, from the wreck of antiquity. I'd say that Houseman's classicism is clearly bound up with his queer suffering. He's attempting to deal with a sense of loss in his scholarship as well as in his poetry. And I want to suggest that that might encourage us queers to be more honest about why we might be attracted to classics as a discipline in which loss is inherent. The queer heritage that antiquity offers to us is clearly one of its attractions, but we have to weigh that up against the loss of so much of antiquity. The fact that we cannot, to borrow a phrase from John Addington Symonds, join hands across time and space with our queer forebears. I think one of the meanings of the lost country that's mourned in Houseman's adaptation of Sappho in Last Poems 10, if you flip back on your handout, one of those meanings of the lost country is surely that it's the lost country of classical antiquity. A country which Houseman, many other queer people of his generation, poignantly knew offered a safe haven to queer love. But this lost country is one, however much we want to get there, we simply can't, even if we're professional classicists. I said earlier on that I don't really believe in the separation that people have tried to make between Houseman the poet, who's all passion and emotion, and Houseman the classical scholar, who's dry as dust and timid and running away from his emotions. I could have chosen many different passages to illustrate this on your handout, but I just chose the very last one I've got there, where he's discussing in a paper called A Transposition in Propertius, an issue of Latin textual criticism. A transposition in Propertius sounds awfully stuffy and dry as dust, and not the sort of thing that might contain passion at all. But I see real passion in these lines he's writing about, when he's writing about the love that Theseus and Pirithous, Achilles and Patroclus have for each other. He's talking about queer couples from the Greek world here. And he's using really emotive language in his scholarship here about how Theseus and Achilles are everlasting remembrances of their less famous comrades and keep their character and story from oblivion. No one sees the knight, but he recalls the squire. So indissoluble is the bond. I'm certain that one of the things that must have attracted Houseman to the classics are stories like this. The possibility that he might be the one who gets to preserve the memory of the man he loves, because that bond was indissoluble. He loved Jackson all his life, even though it was completely hopeless. And classics obviously didn't help him to get over that love, but I think it did help him articulate that love and that sense of loss and longing that he experienced. Thank you.
OutStories Bristol would like to thank Professor Inglehart for her wonderful lecture. Our thanks are also due to the Institute for Greece, Rome and Classical Tradition of the University of Bristol for their support in putting on these lectures over the years.